You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. News about Neanderthals. Two major journals this week, Science and Nature, carry research papers announcing the mapping of parts of the genetic code of one of our closest relatives, the Neanderthals. The DNA the biologist used was taken from a male Neanderthal who lived about 38,000 years ago in present-day Croatia. Scientists say the genetic information they are mining might answer some long-standing questions about how the Neanderthals lived, about their life, and actually why they died out. No one really knows why. What happened to them? Maybe we'll be able to figure that out. Joining me now to talk about that and to learn more about this prehistoric DNA are my guests, Richard Klein, a paleoanthropologist at Stanford University. He joins us from the campus there. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Klein.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Edward Rubin is director of the Genomics Division at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. He's also director of the Department of Energy's Joint Genome Institute in Walnut Creek, California. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Rubin.
Hello, Ira. Pleasure to be on the program.
Dr. Rubin, tell us about this DNA you sequenced. How much of the genome does it actually represent?
Right. So it's just a drop in the bucket. And so our study that generated about 65,000 bits of genetic information, and that's in the context of a genome that's 3 billion bits of genetic information. So we just barely dipped in.
Mm-hmm. And what's interesting about this is it's being hailed. In fact, in a paper in Science, Richard Klein, you say that the Neanderthals were the immediate predecessors of modern humans. And how close were they? Give us a little bit of a thumbnail sketch of where they were in relationship to when people were living, or modern-day Homo sapiens.
Well, modern-day Homo sapiens originated in Africa sometime within the last 200,000 years and spread from Africa to Eurasia about 50,000 years ago. The Neanderthals were already living in Europe at that point. They had begun to evolve there. We can see traces of their features in people as much as 500,000 or 600,000 years ago. And they appeared in Europe, evolved full-blown in Europe by perhaps 150 or 200,000 years ago, and then disappeared after modern humans arrived from Africa sometime around 35 or 40,000 years ago.
And do we know why they disappeared?
Well, that's a controversial issue. I think I know why.
Yeah.
But not all my colleagues agree.
Well, give us your take on it.
Well, I think basically they were out-competed for the same resources that modern humans and Neanderthals required. They were both groups were hunter-gatherers, but the modern humans, if we want, we can call them Cro-Magnons, having arrived from Africa with a very much more advanced technology, probably a different kind of social organization, all sorts of behavioral traits which allowed them to exploit the environment much more effectively than Neanderthals could. And I think that the Neanderthals just suffered from the loss of the food items that they now had to compete for, and they became extinct probably very quickly in any given locale, probably within a few hundred years, although it might have taken as much as 6,000 or 7,000 years for them to disappear all across Europe, on the east and moving to the west.
I'm sorry. Eddie Rubin, can you tell from the DNA more about this story, about the interbreeding and when they disappeared, and add clues to this puzzle?
Right. And so what's important about the study, I think, is that there has been a hurdle to getting their nuclear DNA from these ancient creatures. And the studies show that this is no longer a hurdle. And so we're going to get a lot more sequence in the very near future. But what we can learn from what we got does begin to give us some numbers about, you know, first of all, you said it was a male. And we couldn't tell that from looking at the bone. But looking at the DNA, we could tell it was a male because it had bits of the Y chromosome. And as far as what we've learned, it appears that the numbers suggest that about 700,000 years ago, Neanderthals, or the precursors to Neanderthals, the precursors to Homo sapiens, came off a common ancestral population that were the precursor, the common ancestor. And then, you know, the data suggests that around 400,000 years ago, the populations went their separate ways with minimal admixture after that point. And that was before we see in the fossil record representations of Neanderthals and Homo sapiens. So it suggests that they went their separate ways earlier on and had minimal mixing. And then there's the question that the public is enormously interested in, and that is about recent mixing. And our data doesn't support that, but it's it's only a small amount of data. And so I think that with time, maybe it'll change. Maybe we'll see hints of that. But we don't see any hints with what we have now. But I think as far as the dates of when we come from a common ancestor and when the populations went split, I think those dates will probably hold as we get more data. I think the issue of mixing, I think that will, you know, we'll probably need a whole genome before we're able to nail that one.
We're talking about a specimen that's tens of thousands of years old. How do you find viable DNA in something like that?
Yeah, so that's an exciting aspect of the work, in that you wouldn't have thought we could.
Yeah.
But what it is really it comes from the fact that most when you have this carcass in the edge of a cave, it becomes a nutrient rich resource for bugs and, you know, plants to live off of it. You give it 40,000 years, and it's mostly what you have there are the organisms that have been, or the DNA from the organisms that have been living off those nutrients. But with the increasing throughput of sequencing and decreasing cost, suddenly we could think, well, maybe if we just sequence and sequence amongst all the microbial contaminants and using computational tools to sift through it, we would see some of the original hosts, that Neanderthal, and that's in fact what happened. In that we were able to use high throughput sequencing and see amongst the mixture of DNAs there was some of that ancient creature that we were interested in, and that's why that's what's somewhat science fictiony about it, is that a few years ago we wouldn't have thought that was feasible. And it's only with these increasing throughputs of sequencing that now makes it feasible.
Richard Klein, does that mean now that we've entered a paradigm shift in anthropology and how anthropologists work, that instead of looking at the fossils and bones, anthropologists will learn a lot more from looking at the DNA and searching for it?
Well, the DNA has made an enormous difference. And it's not just the DNA that has been extracted from ancient Neanderthal bones, but the DNA of living humans. If you go back 20 years, there was a popular view in paleoanthropology and human evolutionary studies that the Neanderthals might actually be the ancestors of living humans, or at least of living Europeans. Mm-hmm. And we seemed to be in a situation where we were going to argue about that endlessly. And then in 1987, a landmark paper was published by Alan Wilson and some of his students at the University of California at Berkeley, where they showed that if you looked at one kind of DNA in living humans, it was clear that all living humans shared a recent common ancestor within the last 200,000 years, and that common ancestor lived in Africa. The work was a little controversial to begin with, but it was ultimately well substantiated. And then in 1997, the Leipzig group, which has been working with Dr. Rubin, got the first of what we now consider to be ancient Neanderthal DNA, a different kind of DNA than Dr. Rubin has just been talking about. But it was the first hint that the Neanderthals, in terms of their genes, were in fact quite different from us. And now the issue, as far as paleoanthropologists is concerned, is not whether the Neanderthals are our ancestors, but the issue that Dr. Rubin referred to a moment ago about whether, in fact, when modern humans appeared in Europe, they might have interbred a little bit with the Neanderthals. Mm-hmm. No one, I think, believes today that the Neanderthals are directly ancestral to living humans. But it's all because of genetics that this has changed. And what Dr. Rubin's work is going to tell us, ultimately, is whether, in fact, there was interbreeding. And more importantly, it'll get at the behavioral differences, I think, between Neanderthals and ourselves, and then help us to explain who we are and why the Neanderthals aren't here anymore, why we replaced them.
Dr. Rubin, what kind of behavioral differences can you tell by looking at the genes?
Right. And so, I mean, those kind of questions are the exciting horizons, and it's a bit like, you know, I like thinking about how the sequence data will change the field a bit, in that it's a little bit like Egyptianology, when in the past we just had the pyramids, and then eventually we cracked hieroglyphics and we began to learn things about everyday life of Egyptians that we wouldn't have learned from their structures. But before we cracked it, we didn't know what it was going to tell us. And I think the same thing with regard to sequence data and genome sequence data, what's going to tell us about the biology, and that we have bones and we have associated artifacts, and that's told us a lot. And the sequence data is really going to tell us, open this whole new window, but it's hard to speculate exactly on what we're going to be able to see through that window. And, And what we're going to learn about Neanderthals really is all based on what we're going to learn about the human genome, because the human genome, eventually, as we sequence thousands of humans, which will be occurring in the next 10 or 20 years, and we're able to associate particular sequence changes with particular biological features, and we're not sure what kind of biology we're going to be able to associate with sequence changes, but when we see that in humans, we'll be able to go back into the Neanderthal genome and say, do they have those sequence changes? And if they do, then we'll associate with specific biology. And so as far as speculating about what are we going to learn, I can say that we're going to learn, you know, possibilities or things like, you know, people have speculated that there are genes and sequences involved in language. But I think there's a whole gamut of things that we're probably going to learn. It's just hard to tell at this point.
And questions of intelligence also, perhaps?
You know, what are we going to learn from the human genome? Are we going to learn about, you know, predilections for violence or all kinds of different, or interests in language or interests in music? You know, those are the kind of things that we may learn from the human genome, and if we do, then we'll be able to lay it back upon the Neanderthal genome and speculate that they had those, they potentially possess those characteristics.
Richard Klein, are there disagreements among anthropologists that this DNA might settle now?
Oh, yes. I think a major issue, which may not be all that important, but at least to paleoanthropologists, it's one we argue about, is this question of whether there is a Neanderthal contribution or was a Neanderthal contribution to the modern human gene pool. My own view, and I think this is basically Dr. Rubin's at this point, who speak for himself, of course, is that if there was one, it was probably very small. But we'll be able to say much more about that when we have the complete Neanderthal genome or something like the complete Neanderthal genome, and hopefully more than one for more than one individual.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, and then there's this issue of why the Neanderthals are extinct. Dr. Rubin referred to the possibility that they might or might not have had language in the way that we do. We know of a gene that in living humans that is involved in speech and language. It's called FOXP2. And it seems to have been fixed by natural selection very, very suddenly, sometime within the last 200,000 years. It can't be much more precise than that. But it would be very interesting to know what that gene looked like in Neanderthals. Was it like us, or was it maybe a little bit more like it would be in chimpanzees? And with that kind of question in mind, we can begin to get at the issue of whether Neanderthals were enough like us so that we might have expected them to survive. They didn't. My guess is that it's going to turn out that they were biologically different from us for genetic reasons, behaviorally different from us for genetic reasons, and that's much of the reason why they disappeared.
We're talking about Neanderthal this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News with Richard Klein and Edward Rubin, 1-800-989-8255. Do you have enough DNA to sequence the whole genome, or do you have to find more of it?
Yeah, I think that the group in Leipzig does have enough DNA to get a very rough draft of the human genome, and the German government is supporting a big effort over the next few years to do that. And we're at the same time trying to begin the process of collecting several different samples, and our hope is to be able to get material from several Neanderthals and take other kinds of approaches where we're able to reach in and pull out specific sequences that we're interested in several different Neanderthals, and be able to both feel confident that the sequence we're seeing is authentic based on its appearance in several Neanderthals, as well as be able to look at specific genes that we're interested in, and not doing whole genome sequencing, but rather more targeted approaches.
Let me see if I can get a quick phone call in before we have to go. John in San Rafael. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, it's a great discussion. My question is, isn't too much attention being paid to Neanderthal? Isn't Neanderthal nothing more than a European variant of advanced Homo erectus? And when I say European, I mean I'm going from the Shanidar specimen up to...
John, I got about a minute left. You have to make your question and not give us a lecture on this one.
That's my question.
Okay.
I mean, there's talk about interbreeding with Homo with Neanderthal. As advanced humans dispersed from East Africa 100,000 or so years ago, isn't there...
Let me get an answer.
I'll give you a practical response.
Go ahead, Richard.
Response.
Eddie, go ahead.
Yeah, I'll give you a practical response in that getting DNA from a 40,000-year-old specimen is really pushing the limits. And so to think about going to erectus samples that are hundreds of thousands of years, I think that's, you know, right now seems beyond the limits. And so that's one practical reason. Also, we're interested in our commonest, our most recent common ancestor, our first cousins. And I think Neanderthal fits it for that bill. And so I think that's part of the reason why we're so interested in Neanderthals.
Mm-hmm. Richard, would you agree?
Well, there is the possibility, I suppose, and Dr. Rubin could comment on this, of finding 40, 50,000-year-old non-modern fossils in East Asia.
Right.
No one's really tried very hard to do that at this point, but ones that might retain DNA. And sure, they will not be Neanderthals. There'll be another kind of non-modern people, and we'd also like to know how they differ genetically from ourselves and from the Neanderthals.
Well, yeah, that was my last question. Is everybody going to go now back through their bones, knowing that what couldn't be done can be done, possibly?
Yeah, I think that a few years ago, you wouldn't have thought that getting Neanderthal nuclear DNA was possible, and it's clearly possible, and I think it's likely we're going to have the whole genome soon. And so, you know, who knows what the edge of what's possible. It's particularly connected to new technologies and new sequencing technologies that allow us to drive, you know, thousand folds and million folds more data than we used to be able to do.
So do you continue now trying to finish up this sequence?
Well, I think that the German group is going to finish the sequence of this particular bone, and we're developing technologies to try to make it less destructive, where we have to destroy less bone, as well as collecting samples from several specimens.
Mm-hmm. Richard Klein, where do you think this is headed?
I think that it'll resolve some very important issues in paleoanthropology. I think the public often thinks that paleoanthropologists are prima donnas who just like to argue endlessly among themselves and they never resolve issues. The genetics is going to resolve a lot of important issues for us, including this issue of whether these archaic kinds of people that used to live in Eurasia, the Neanderthals in particular, contributed in any way to us, and again, why they're gone.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think in addition it will change the field in some ways, and this is a little bit what Ira mentioned earlier, in that it is a fairly data-poor field that is based on a limited number of skeletal remains and associated artifacts that are frequently hard to access by curators in faraway places. And all the data that's being generated, all the sequence data, is all freely available on the web. And so, you know, in the future, I think scientists and geneticists and anthropologists will be able to sit at their terminals and access this.
I've got to take a break. Gentlemen, stay with us. Stay with us through the break. We'll be right back. Talk lots more with Richard Klein, Eddie Rubin, and see if we can get a question or two in from you folks out on the phone. So stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about Neanderthals and papers written in Nature and Science magazine. In fact, one of the News and Views comments in Nature said that these papers are perhaps the most significant contributions published in this field since the discovery of Neanderthals 150 years ago. Our number 1-800-989-8255. What's the right way to say that name? Is it Neanderthals or Neanderthals, or can it be said either way?
Well, I can give you my answer.
Okay.
initially, when they were discovered, the first Neanderthal fossil to be recognized for what it was came from a place called the Neander Valley near Dusseldorf, Germany. Valley in German at the time was spelled T-H-A-L. Later on, there was a spelling change, and the H was dropped. However, I think that with or without the H, and some people use the H today and some people don't, that is, some specialists, I think you could say Neanderthal rather than Neanderthal. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it matters a whole lot.
Mm-hmm. Let me see if I can get a phone call or two before we have to go. Let's go to Anita in Sunnyvale, California. Hi, Anita.
Hi. I have two very quick questions. Number one, what is the mutation rate that you're using to estimate the 700,000 and 400,000 mark of the split? And number two, do you think you can get any DNA from the Portuguese boy who is supposedly a hybrid? And I'll take the answers off the air. Thank you.
Okay.
Right. And so the way that the split is calculated, the divergence time, is when they come back to a common ancestor. And that is basically looking at the number of variations that we see between the human, Neanderthal, and chimp genome. And from that, you eventually, and it assumes the chimp having diverged from Neanderthals and Homo sapiens 5 to 8 million years ago. And so it looks at the sequence that leads to the common ancestor, and it's primarily focused, and also takes in models of populations, and so it's a complex calculation. In a similar way, the split time looks at the estimated population sizes, as well as looks at variations that occur within humans, as well as the variations, the derived and ancestral alleles that we see in the Neanderthal sequence. And so I guess this is a short answer to a very long question. And the second one was, getting material from... Yeah, I think that one would like to get material from all these samples. And I think the one that was referred to is one of the issues of there being a hybrid between Neanderthal and Homo sapien phenotypic features, thinking that this was a transitional state. And sure, getting sequence from that would help address the issue, whether it's just an abnormality in structure or whether it really indeed represents a transition.
Well, gentlemen, I want to thank you for taking time to talk with us today. Richard Klein, paleoanthropologist at Stanford University, and Eddie Rubin, director of the Department of Energy's Joint Genome Institute in Walnut Creek, California. Thanks, and have a good weekend to both of you.
Okay.
Thank you very much.